a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Youth Summit, taking place February 12th and February 13th at the Blazers Boys and Girls Club in Portland. February 12th will feature a workshop called Healing Ourselves to Raise Our Future and a performance by spoken word artist S. Renee Mitchell. February 13th will feature workshops on topics ranging from becoming an MC to healthy living to information on going to Africa. That evening, the summit will close with a youth talent showcase. Again, that's the Portland Youth Summit, February 12th and 13th at the Blazers Boys and Girls Club, 5250 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kbo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9 a.m. Today on Political Perspectives, we hear excerpts from a panel discussion called Report Back from COP21, Paris Climate Talks. It was recorded on January 20th at the Peace House in Portland. The event was co-hosted by the Portland Central American Solidarity Committee, Right to Survive, and 350 PDX. Thanks to Paul Rowland for recording this program. The first speaker is Virginia Wiseman, a volunteer with 350 PDX. She also reports on environmental negotiations and conferences for the Earth Negotiations Bulletin for the International Institute for Sustainable Development. Now to back from COP21 Paris Climate Talks.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the structure of the talks in Paris and then give some observations about the process and the outcome if there's time. I think everyone knows that everything that happened in Paris was under sort of the umbrella of the UNFCCC, or the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was adopted in 1992, and then it came into force in 1994. And I'm just going to say one note about procedures under the UNFCCC. The parties have never managed to adopt their voting rules, and so everything operates on the basis of consensus. And that often ends up meaning that agreements and decisions, whatever's being negotiated, gets watered down. And it's because it's hard. It's 196 parties, 195 countries plus the EU is a party in itself. And as a side note, we will soon have another party at the very end of COP21. It was quite late, and most people had left to celebrate the agreement. But it was late because after the agreement was adopted, every single party pretty much felt the need to give a statement about what they liked in the agreement, what they didn't, thanking the presidency, and so on and so forth. And so I think a little after midnight, Palestine, as an observer state, took the floor and announced that they would be submitting their instrument of acceptance to the UNFCCC. So they will soon be the 197th party. So fast forward from 1994, when the convention came into force, and to Paris in December of 2015. The first week of the conference in Paris was still technical negotiations, which had actually been meeting since May of 2012. And at the end of the week, on the Saturday, in the middle of the two-week conference, they had pretty much taken the text as far as they could before political decisions needed to be taken by ministers. And so they passed off the text to the COP, the Conference of the Parties. And at that point, France really took the stage as the presidency of the COP, and Laurent Fabius, the foreign minister of France, presided over the negotiations as the president of COP21. And I can talk about the mode of work that the French presidency put in place, but if you're interested later. But just a few observations on the process. Not long after the French really took the reins, I sort of felt like a big sense of optimism started to pervade the plenary halls and the meeting rooms. Delegates they didn't seem to have the level of negative stress that I was expecting anyway. And I was more optimistic than I had been all year that we were actually going to get some agreement by the end of the conference. And I think that was quite a feat on the part of the French presidency. They had a couple, things stacked up against them. One, having to overcome a huge lack of trust in the process. You can feel it when you're there. Delegates do not trust each other. There's not a lot of reaching across the aisle, so to speak. Developing countries do not trust the developed world very much. And the other strike against France is that they're a developed country. And for whatever reason, there's different theories or explanations out there for it, but COPs that happen in developing countries tend to be more successful. But they overcame this. I think they did a pretty good job. They learned their lessons, both good and bad, from previous conferences like that in Copenhagen, which was largely a failure, and more successful ones like Durban. On trust, they managed to keep the process very open, transparent, and inclusive. Parties do not like when there's backroom deals that just involve a few of the biggest players and where they decide, so to speak, what everybody else is going to agree to. There's a lot of backlash when that happens. And then on being a developed country, they did something that was really smart. They really involved Peru, which had presided over COP20 in Lima, in everything from day one. They cemented that relationship through something called the Lima-Paris Action Agenda, which also brought non-state actors into the fold a lot more than they had in the past. And speaking of non-state actors, the French, with all their diplomatic prowess, obviously didn't do it alone. There was huge pressure from civil society in countries all around the world, and you could tell that governments felt that pressure, that they really wanted a deal in Paris. They definitely didn't want another Copenhagen. You also had the support of business versus, for instance, the Kyoto Protocol did not have much support from the business community. Leading up to Paris, in the couple years leading up to it, there were a lot of commitments from companies, both big and small, which was pretty exciting. And then the UN Secretary General threw his weight behind these negotiations and really made climate change a big priority in his tenure. And so there were those factors, and then there was another potential factor that contributed to the success. In the second week of the talks, this high ambition coalition sort of emerged, and it had been formed among some countries in secret in the months leading up to the talks, and the Marshall Islands led it with a lot of heavy involvement from the U.S. and others, and it sort of became the cool kids club, where if you wanted an ambitious agreement, then you were in the high ambition coalition, you were pushing for the 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold. And it was an effort to marginalize any countries that were sort of holdouts against having an ambitious agreement. Whether or not they contributed to the success, I'm sure will be analyzed in the future. They might have just latched on to something that was already a foregone conclusion, but it was an interesting development. One other anecdote, and then I'll go on to the outcome a little bit more. Negotiators love to obsess over every last comma. And I swear, there's this little tiny paragraph in the decision, paragraph 14, that is two lines. And I swear, I was in one session, they spent 45 minutes on it. And all it is asking the secretariat to post something on the website. So it can be excruciating, but sometimes one word makes a huge difference. And in the on the very last day of the talks, that was the case. The final agreement had come out at about 1:30 that day, that Saturday, December 12th, and we were supposed to convene in plenary at 5:30, hopefully, to adopt the agreement. And it turned out, well, we were waiting, and they hadn't started at 6 o'clock, and that's typical. Things tend to start late, but then we noticed that the dais up front, where you needed all the main players to be there to start the meeting, was now empty. And they were sort of running around, and there were people milling around on the floor, and some of the really big heavy hitters were huddling and talking very seriously to one another. And then the Twitter sphere erupted that it was Article 4.4 that was the problem, and there was a shall, and it should have been a should. And in international law, shall means legally binding and should means not. And so it could have broken down the talks. This is a paragraph on developed countries having economy-wide emission reduction targets. And it would have meant the U.S., whether or not the U.S. could join the agreement. The French presidency, again, handled that with skill. And they ended up just reading it off as a technical error. And the agreement was adopted before we knew what happened. But if I have, can I say a couple words on the outcome? So it's been billed as universal, which is an interesting way to look at it, because the UNFCCC is an example of what we would normally think of an agreement with universal participation. And that's because we have nearly every country in the world as a party, whereas the Paris Agreement doesn't have any parties yet. It's not even open for signature yet. And we'll need 55 countries to ratify it, and they'll need to represent at least 55% of global emissions for it to come into force. But when people say universal, they're comparing it to the Kyoto Protocol and to some extent the Cancun Agreements, where there was still that distinct difference between Annex 1, or developed countries, and non-Annex 1 countries, which are developing countries. And those annexes are not in the agreement. They're not mentioned anymore. And the U.S. and others really worked to change that paradigm so that every country would have to have a contribution under the new agreement. And because we do have 188 intended nationally determined contributions already, I am confident that we will hit the ratifications and the percentage of emissions needed for it to come into force. But it's definitely an evolution in climate governance to expect developing countries to do more. And then these contributions will be ratcheted up every 5 years, and there will be a global stock take to assess progress. And the contributions cannot sort of backtrack. They have to always be a progression over the last one. And those are kind of like one of the main parts of the agreement. The other big points are that the long-term goal includes both the 2 degrees Celsius threshold, and parties also will pursue efforts to keep warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius. And parties intend to peak emissions as soon as possible, and they hope to reach net zero emissions in the second half of this century. And I'll leave it there because I think I'm out of time. Sorry.
Great. Thank you, Virginia. So our next panelist is Jill Stein, who is an organizer, physician, and environmental health activist. She has led initiatives promoting healthy communities, local green economies, and the revitalization of democracy, addressing issues such as environmental, economic, and racial justice, campaign, finance reform, green jobs, and the cleanup of incinerators, coal plants, and toxic substances. She was a principal organizer for the Global Climate Convergence for People, Planet, and Peace over Profit. Previously, she served on the Massachusetts and National Boards of Directors for Physicians for Social Responsibility, where she worked on environmental health and nuclear disarmament.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for being here. Thanks to the organizer. Thank you to the Peace House for hosting us here. And thank you, Virginia, for that very wonderful, I guess, sort of official view of the conference. I have a very unofficial view of the conference. I was there as an insurgent, a presidential candidate, with a very different point of view. And, you know, I'll say that I was outside of the official conference. I actually did have observer status, but I didn't wind up using it. And I was out in the People's Climate Summit and at an event, a forum that I was able to do jointly with the deputy chief negotiator from China and with many members of indigenous tribes from the Northwest. And it was this very interesting mix of China, U.S., progressive viewpoint, and indigenous tribes. And at the Climate Summit, I'll just say, I wound up doing several workshops on the on climate and militarism and climate and war. And it felt really good to be doing that, because the summit and the COP, in my experience, was not only about the climate crisis, it was also about the war crisis, because the war had come to Paris in the form of the terrorist blowback that had just happened. So it was very much on people's minds. And the crisis in democracy was also very much on people's minds, especially the climate justice movement, which was precluded from having its demonstrations and its gatherings. So it was like the voice of people was being silenced, but the voice of industry that was well represented inside of the official COP was going strong. And having heard, before I left the country to join the COP, having heard the president's remarks, which basically said that Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg were going to save us, so no worries about the climate, you know, things were going strong, and, you know, and then sort of scoped out the agreement, it made me feel extremely skeptical about what was going on inside of the official COP, and made me much more interested and invested in the people's movement that was congregating there. And I have to say that in these workshops, which is what came first for me, one was with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which was hosting a climate and war workshop. It was very exciting. It felt like we were not only looking the climate crisis in the face, but we were really looking at this incredible blowback from 14 years of this failed war on terror as well, that has only created failed states and massively increased the power of organized global terrorist movements, ISIS and the likes, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, et cetera, whatever you want to look at by any measure, that has gotten much worse, and also the massive refugee crisis. So there was real consciousness of grappling with that and needing to face both of those problems and to understand, you know, how we had to really have a systemic fix to address them both. And there was, I must say, there was really, in my experience, there was great feeling about, you know, this is it, folks. You know, it's time to stop fiddling around the margins, that we really need a fundamental and unified challenge here among the various justice movements, the justice movements and the peace movement and the climate movement, which are really, we're not going to solve this one piece at a time. We really need a unified and comprehensive approach. And I'll come back to sort of specific positions that we were advocating there. So the other crisis, I think, that was very much on display was, again, this crisis of democracy. So all three of them converging. WILF, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, was one of the workshops. The other one was a French-organized workshop, but it was a lot of the European peace groups that were there to grapple with this. And then the other event was this forum, so-called, put on by the Belong organization, which is a nonprofit that works to develop renewable energy in China. And that was extremely interesting and inspired, having the indigenous tribes there, as well as the Chinese, and then our sort of Green Party participation. And it was extremely provocative, and it was sort of a person-to-person, you know, across the globe, how can we make this work together, following in the footsteps of the indigenous tribes who've really kind of put out the vision here. How can we rally around this, and how can we break through the institutional barriers? And that was, I have to say, very uplifting. I want to mention the two solutions that we were really putting forward. And first, let me just say a few other words about the official outcome. While there's a lot of good, you know, aspirational language here, you know, it's mostly language without enforcement, without mechanism. It is voluntary. And even at that, the best it will do is 3.5 degrees centigrade over pre-industrial levels. So, and it also, you know, eliminated the respect for indigenous rights and their incorporation into the agreement. And it also eliminated the real commitments of climate justice and reparations and support for that transition that the developing world needs to make. So personally, I share the James Hansen point of view that this did not get us there. It didn't begin to get us there. And what made it especially or I should say made me especially skeptical, was that at the same time the Obama administration and the White House and Congress were lifting the ban on fossil fuel exports, which amounts to creating 350 new coal plants, at the same time that they were approving a new major pipeline, and also including in the budget agreement language that essentially expedites permitting for pipelines. So that fact, you know, in the face of this much ballyhooed agreement, you know, behind closed doors, the absolute opposite of that agreement taking place, to me says where this is really going. And I want to just very quickly describe what we were putting on the table as the way forward. And we were discussing this with China in the sense of how could we, as grassroots movements, really leapfrog ahead against these this sort of old school view, which is really dictated by fossil fuel companies and predatory banks and war profiteers, you know, who basically sponsor our two establishment political parties and are calling the shots far too much. Most of the time, I would say. We're calling for a Green New Deal, which means an emergency program like the New Deal that got us out of the Great Depression, a Green New Deal which will achieve 100% clean renewable energy by 2030. After Pearl Harbor was bombed, it took us 6 months. We declared a national emergency. It took us 6 months to move the economy to 25% of GDP on a wartime footing. We're calling for doing that now over the next 15 years to move to 100% clean renewable energy. Yay. If we thought Pearl Harbor, you know, was a threat to the health and well-being and the security of the United States, that doesn't hold a candle to what we are looking at now, what we are on the threshold of if we don't undertake dramatic reforms now. So we're calling for 100%, creating 20 million jobs now, focused on creating that green economy, green energy, a green agricultural system, a sustainable local food production, as well as transportation, restoring infrastructure and ecosystems. With 20 million jobs, you can actually do that. And guess what? The good news is that the energy transition pays for itself just looking at the health benefits and the costs of the incredible epidemics that we are currently afflicted with right now from fossil fuel production. So this is a win-win. It pays for itself. It revives the economy, which desperately needs a New Deal-type solution. It transitions and turns the tide on climate change, and it makes wars for oil obsolete. This is what we deserve. This is what we need, and we should settle for nothing less. And I want to give a big shout out to all the grassroots groups here in Portland who are really leading the way for the nation in how we achieve this, in the way that you have fought back one piece of fossil fuel infrastructure after the other. I say, go Portland. The rest of us need to take a lesson from you. And the City Council resolution that there will be no further construction of fossil fuel infrastructure needs to go national, and we are pushing for that as well, that nationally we have an immediate moratorium on all further fossil fuel infrastructure, and we expedite the transition that our lives and the future of the planet depend on now. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jill. So next we will hear from Terry Light, who's a member of Right to Survive, a houseless organizer living at Hazelnut Grove and is in between housing. He has former lives as an activist until he had a break with reality in 1988 and then put himself back together as an Oriental body worker and health educator up to 2008 when he went off the grid to answer the basic question, what are basic human needs? His quest has led him to houseless organizing, beginning with Nicholsville in Seattle, on through rewilding work on the Shoshone and Paiute Hoop, and back into the grid at Portland's houseless community, Dignity Village, in 2011. His work is informed by the recovery movement, his understanding of Native ideals, the pagan community, the queer community, feminism and intersectionality, white resistance, solidarity, and he currently works at Common Ground Wellness Cooperative. Terry went to Paris as a member of the It Takes Roots Coalition.
Hi. I did not attend any of the talks, and I haven't been involved in the climate change movement per se. And my first inkling about connecting to it was when I went to the U.S. Social Forum this last summer and connected with Rising Tide and really hearing a different story about what needed to change. And I was agreeing with those new concepts that it's not so much about changing our ideas about how we treat the environment, but that the very environment that's creating environmental problems is our social justice structure and how we treat each other, how we do democracy, how we listen to each other. And out of the blue, I got invited to be part of the It Takes Roots grassroots mobilization, which was made of the Climate People's Action Group, the Indigenous Environmental Network, and also Grassroots Global Justice, which I was part of that. I wanted to bring back more of some impressions I got from organizing with mostly people of color when it went to Paris. We talked over and over about frontline communities, where communities already experiencing climate change. You know, we've had the flooding here with Katrina, and the communities responded by pulling themselves together, even though a lot of the rest of the country has ignored the racist implications of how people were taken care of after that crisis. It's continuing to be a case, you know, until we have a problem we're experiencing it ourselves that we do anything about. And that just speaks to the kind of the way our cultural idea is, has colonized people inside of a colonized system. We believe that the government's still working, but it's partly because we've grown up inside of it and it seems to be working for us who still have enough privilege to be able to go easy in the world and get help when we need help. Being part of the houseless community, I don't expect help from our police department. I don't expect that if I need something wrong with myself that I'm actually going to get assistance from the community. There's a lot of places where we allow people to be abandoned. When we're talking about Indigenous rights, it's a whole different perspective from Indigenous point of view. They see their role is to take care of all of their relations, the non-humans, the humans, and also paying attention to a different set of goals that involve the generations. So there was a lot of youth involvement in the groups. We had, and there was a lot of elders. There was a lot of talking from different perspectives and coming together and mobilizing. There was a huge amount of passion where we were able to lead the march in the last day of like really breaking away out of the zone where we're allowed to be in. At the very end, it was a little disappointing that there were three projects and not one, but we decided to attend all those protests. So I came away from Paris thinking about we need to have a change of heart, and it's a process. When I think about how do we start really building community of human beings that are really standing up for the rest of nature, and that rest of nature has a huge way of informing ourselves as human beings, because I feel like our culture has forgot about being human. There's large forces that help us identify if as long as we're a worker, then we're allowed to be able to have food and housing and be part of the culture and be listened to. And experience of being houseless is all of a sudden you're not don't have access to communicating with other people, because how we've all been taught that if something happens to us, oh, too bad. And it's kind of unacceptable. Because, like, how can we hear from the urgency of other cultures? We can't even hear the urgency of ourselves and our own communities when we see it in our face. And I feel like it's kind of a hard work to look at. Like, how do we actually come to that place in our heart and carry that with us as we go through our day. It's a bit of a transition. And I think that's what I was speaking to when I talked about when I first had a break with reality. That was when I first saw Native American organizing and realized that my sense of community, I didn't know anything about community. I grew up in the military. I grew up in a normal family, went to school, at church. And it was like in that community, everybody had a right and a birthright to be taken care of, being warm and fed and sheltered from the storm. That was like a big cause of break for me 20 years ago. And I feel like we're like at this moment where we have to transition a big way where everything changes, including ourselves, including the way we think, including like how we consider each day differently. And I think it's really important, like after we're going to talk more, I think later, like what are our next steps? And I think it's like here, inviting the voices, different perspectives into the room to talk about their experiences with climate change, their experience with how they're organized. There's this whole level of needing to come from the heart, and it's also the level of really start talking about spiritualities, that there must be something greater than human beings. And we're not the only sentient being on our planet. There's been a lot of meditating on those things since I came back. One of the last days that we had, the youth led us in an exercise where we appreciated each other. And we don't do that often in direct action organizing because we're so in the war all the time. And that gave me a lot of pause about how traumatizing the very work we're doing is for ourselves. That we have to take time to heal and make that part of our process as human beings and moving forward. And healing, getting to know who we really are. Because nobody really asked us. We went to school. We like assumed that we wouldn't know anything and we just have to go to school and learn and then we'll be smart. And some of the Native communities, they have a different viewpoint. You come in the world and then you're going to discover what you want to do and nobody should tell you what that is. And I feel that strongly about our direct action and organizing, that each person has to decide for themselves in their relationship to their creator what their task is at this moment. Mine is, for me, is like, how do I create connection to we're actually in the same room with each other in this present moment and being present so we can have the opportunity to choose differently? Because I feel that's really strongly in our face right now. And so if you hear this, like one of the things that I was doing is really be inspired to sing more. So I'll still leave you with a song. This is coming from Africa, the Wisdom of Africa. Wangari, she founded the Green Belt Movement, and they created their process. There's four basic elements to their process for decolonizing. And it's really important for us to understand as part of that colonizing culture is that we have to decolonize. So the four basic steps for in that process for me, and this is a song for that, so easy. Love your mother, respect her gifts, stand up, stand up. Don't sit down, oh no. Give what you can when you can. Stand up, stand up. Don't sit down, oh no.
Stand up, stand up. Don't sit down, no.
Give what you can when you can.
Give what you can when you can.
We can do it together. Love your mother, respect her gifts, stand up, stand up, don't sit down, oh no, give what you can when you can. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry, for sharing what you shared with us. Marlena Murphy is an organizer, with the Portland Central America Solidarity Commission, or PCASC.
Committee.
Thank you. Marlena attended COP21 also as part of the It Takes Roots campaign and the Grassroots Global Justice Delegation. And part of the It Takes Roots campaign calls on the U.S. representatives to make binding commitments in response to both science and the demands of frontline communities.
Cool. So, along with Terry and about 60 or 70 other people, we went on this delegation to Paris. It was a delegation that was a collaboration between three different groups. So probably between those three different groups, we had about over 150 people. But there were 1.5 million things going on in Paris, so I don't think there was ever once we were all in the same room, like maybe one time. And so those three groups were the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance, which is made up of member organizations from across the United States, vast majority folks of color, and like frontline and different fence line communities. The Climate Justice Alliance, which I'm still a little iffy on their history, but I believe that that's an alliance that's come out of the COP talks and organizing that's happening between indigenous communities and local communities here in the United States, and then also the Indigenous Environmental Network. So these were the five demands that this delegation had, and I'll read them out loud because I think they're awesome. Number one is establish mandatory, not voluntary, emission cuts at the source. Number two is leave fossil fuels in the ground. Number three is reject fracking, nuclear power, carbon markets, and other dangerous technologies and false solutions. Four is strengthen the inclusion of human rights, and particularly the rights of indigenous peoples. And five is support community-rooted solutions, including regional and local economic structures that support the production of renewable energy. Right? Yeah, it's been awesome. I don't know, I just read an article today that was sort of about the sort of like lack of concrete demands in the climate movement, and so that's why I wanted to put these up here, because I think they're really clear, actionable items that very easily could have been acted on at the Paris climate talks and weren't, for reasons that I'm sure we all know. But I'm going to talk about three main actions that GGJ and this delegation helped organize and help make happen. The first was this Indigenous Canoe Action that happened about like 2 days after we got there. I'm not any type of expert on the COP agreement at all, but my understanding is there's a preamble, and then there's like the text of the agreement. And the text of the agreement is what's legally binding, although without any sort of like global police force or whatever, I'm not even sure what like legally binding means, you know? But basically, the IEN and our delegation was fighting to have the rights of indigenous peoples and women and displaced peoples and migrants and refugees like kept in the latter part of the text, which is the legally binding part. And through negotiations, pressure from Western nations, the US, Australia, stuff like that, basically that part got pushed to the non-legally binding preamble part, which I believe is the only place in the text that indigenous rights are mentioned. So in response, tribes from kind of all over the world, there's a really strong delegation from the Lummi Nation who are up in Washington, and they came and... Yeah, folks from all over the world came and did this canoe action in a branch of the Seine. That was really wonderful and awesome, and I think was really effective in sort of like getting that message out there and getting that critique out there. This is a canoe that's made by the Sarayaku tribe, which is there in the Ecuadorian Amazon. And this canoe is made from one tree. They burned it out of one tree, and they flew it, I guess, from the Amazon to Paris. And it was like held up in customs for like a really, really long time, and so it wasn't there for the ceremony. But as part of the ceremony, when it finally got to Paris, it had to be unloaded and touch the water in the same place, and they had to sort of do the part of the ritual that they would have done when the rest of the ritual was going on. So we unloaded it, and then they boated in it. It was just, I don't know, super sacred and amazing. I don't know if I can be as articulate as I want to about it. So that was the first big action. The second one, we, in partnership with La Via Campesina, went to the Vincennes, maybe, detention center. which is, you know, pretty hidden away in this remote corner of Paris. Took like an hour and a half to get there on the train. And, you know, there's a bunch of climate refugees who are being held in detention there. So we went and we did a noise demo outside it so that they could hear us inside, and to highlight the hypocrisy of the talks and how, you know, France itself is producing emissions that are causing people to be displaced from their home countries, and then when they come to their borders, putting them in detention centers. Again, with Levia Campesina, that had some really awesome media messaging about the climate talks. And important to note in this, I'm just going to read you this quote, because other people make words better than I do. One of the key recommendations from the Advisory Group on Climate Change and Human Mobility is to fund adaptation strategies that support communities to remain, as well as strategies to safely migrate through a climate change displacement coordination facility. Proposed by low-lying countries in the Global South, the recommendation was opposed by Western countries, especially Australia, and was entirely scrapped from the final agreement. So basically, there was this coalition of, like, developing nations that was like, we need to have agreements about how developed nations are going to handle the influx of climate refugees. And it was one of their main... It's called the LDC, the Least Developed Countries. It was one of their main recommendations leading up to the talks. And before the talks even started, that recommendation was shoved aside by, like, mainly the U.S. and Australia. So nowhere in the text does the word climate refugees appear. Actually, nowhere in the text does the words fossil fuels appear, I learned. These are all awesome people. I wish I could talk to you for hours about how awesome all of them are, but I'm kind of too nervous to even remember anyone's name right now. And so then the last one, this was sort of GGJ's big day and our big action. It was on December 10th, which was Human Rights Day, and we did an action at the Peace Wall, and the Peace Wall is on the other side of the Champ du Mars from the Eiffel Tower, which is the Park of Mars, which is like the war god. I learned like all these like towns in France used to have these like central parks that were like tributes to war gods. So there's a peace wall there now. And that's where we decided to have our action. And we had, you know, sort of like part theater piece, part rally. And there were all these speakers from communities all across the United States. And the intention of the action was basically to call out the US's role in forcing a corporate agenda in the climate talks, and to talk about how communities in the United States have been resisting and are continuing to resist. So I'm going to read you some words in a few minutes, but basically there were a whole bunch of speakers, really, really beautiful and inspiring. But the theater piece was, the name of the delegation is It Takes Roots to Weather the Storm. So the theater piece was basically sort of like identifying the storm, which is what this is, all these different threats, you know, corporations, false solutions, patriarchy, politicians, fracking, all the things. And then basically like all these community people kind of like rushed in and like tore down the problems, the storm. And then we did a big spreading seeds of hope and community and rootedness. And then we had a big round dance at the end right there. I was, like, trying to come up with inspiring things, and I realized that hella people have already written inspiring stuff about this stuff, so I'm just going to read you a quote from my friend Sheena, who works for the Asian Pacific Environmental Network out of the Bay. And she wrote an article about this action in this day, and she says, "As it stands, the COP21 agreement is brewing another kind of storm for communities on the front line. World leaders converge to talk about greenhouse gas emissions in the parts per million, keeping up endless growth through a force of green consumers, and making sure polluters and their false promises can come along for the ride without losing any profits. Without long-term vision, accountability, and concrete steps to decarbonizing all economies, we're headed toward destruction that neither we nor this planet deserve. At the end of these talks, much is being heralded about the U.S. actually signing on to an agreement despite internal right-wing pressure and climate deniers in Congress. There's a lot of talk about state-by-state innovations, including California Governor Jerry Brown pushing offset agreements with regional partners. These steps are at best helping climate change become a daily conversation. At worst, they're pushing for increased privatization, confiscation of indigenous people's lands, loss of cultural and biological diversity, and human rights violations. What we need now post-COP is bold action to keep fossil fuels in the ground, reject the fundamentalist ideology of globalization, a commitment to the well-being of people over the profiteering of a few, and infrastructure and resource support for locally owned and controlled renewable energy solutions. Earlier this month, I traveled to Paris as part of the It Takes Root delegation to build towards just that, a community rooted deeply in place, connected globally through solidarity, and that has the strength and know-how to weather all the storms that are yet to come. We know our communities have been on the cutting edge of true climate resiliency work for generations. We have always been the ones hit first and worst, and we're still here and will continue to lead the transformative path towards a regenerative economy and a living planet. Yeah. GGJ really emphasizes the need for a just transition into a non-fossil fuel economy and the need to not leave anybody behind in that transition. They had a just transition assembly on one of our final days there and outlined their principles for a just transition. And they did a lot of calling out false solutions, including the RED program, which is reducing emissions through deforestation and destruction. It's a carbon trading scheme. It's pretty evil, and it's being implemented on statewide levels. California is currently engaged on a state level in a carbon trading program with folks in the Amazon. Yeah, they called that out left and right and everywhere they could, as well as incineration. Incineration is another one of those false solutions that's being proposed. And then some smaller actions that I felt really honored to be a part of. This was a panel. There were two different spaces at the official climate talks, one which you need a badge to get into, and then one was this sort of like green space where anyone could go into, and it was like full of all this like greenwashing propaganda and weird stuff. And they held a panel there for these climate heroes that included the governor of Vermont, who is actively working to get a frack gas pipeline built in Vermont, some folks from Canada, someone from California, and then someone from Governor Inslee's office, right? And so like 30 of us rolled in there, and basically every time these folks tried to talk, we just stood up and we shouted them down, right? I got to shout down the lady from Inslee's office about the proposed Tesoro Savage Vancouver oil terminal, and they ended that shit early, you know, and it was really great. The governor Shumlin right there, you can see in the corner, he was prepared for it. Like, he was like one of those slimy politicians and could deal with it. But like everyone else was just a cabinet member. Like, they had no clue. Like, their faces were like draining of blood, and you could tell they were kind of shaking and scared. And that was really awesome. Yeah, that was some of the most fun I had. And then this other one, I got to go with these ladies, and these ladies are amazing. They are out of Australia. They're called the Climate Angels. It's an all-female collective with a few men in support roles. And briefly, okay, so ENGIE is the biggest energy supplier in the EU, right? And they changed their name recently, but before they changed their name, they were the owners and operators of this coal mine in a rural town in Australia. And they cut back the safety review budget for this mine until it was only being inspected once every 6 months. So the coal mine caught fire and burned for 45 days before it was put out. And it was only put out through the volunteer efforts of the local town, right? And so, like, kids were coming home from school with, like, nosebleeds, and, like, people were, like, collapsing in the street in the local town. Like, 11 or 12 people have died. So these ladies came from Australia and basically shut down ENGIE's headquarters and blocked the doors, and they had to evacuate the building. And they shut it down for the rest of the day. And I was just like, they were so amazing, you know, and so powerful. And just like, yeah, really had it together and were so calm and collected. And all these riot cops showed up and they didn't flinch, you know. So they're demanding like something like $1.2 billion in payment, which is like what the county is in debt for, like, cleaning up this fire from this mine. Just to close, I'll say that Pam Tao Li was on our delegation. She's this amazing Chinese elder. She works for the Chinese Progressive Association out of the Bay right now, but she's one of the founders of the Asian Pacific Environmental Network. And she just, like, yeah, so full of, like, love and clarity and amazingness. And I called her today, and I was like, Pam, I gotta do a report back. I don't know what to say. Tell me what to say. So she said, quote, "Tell them they truly need to hear the voices of frontline communities and authentically take these to heart. The movement we want to build is based on relationships and trust, and the stands these organizations take, especially the big greens and NGOs, are important to these communities. If the leaders of these organizations don't believe their organization is ready to take a stand on colonialism and environmental racism, they need to challenge their membership to step up. That's the very last slide. That's the outside of the climate talks. That says Blood for Oil on the United States flag. So those are all my pictures from the delegation. And to really, really close, I think I would just say that I want to really echo what Jill said. Like, I'm not a climate scientist. I barely understand this. I did a lot of reading after the talks were over to try to understand what they really mean. These are like voluntary commitments. The percentage reductions in terms of like current emissions versus the like voluntary commitments that people are making to reducing their emissions, like the percentages coming out of developing nations are massively higher than the percentages coming out of developed nations. Developed nations are doing everything they can to make these voluntary, non-binding, and to like escape every level of responsibility in any way, you know, on a humanitarian way, on an ecological way, on an economic way. My understanding is that there's going to be these reviews every 5 years. People are hoping for this like 1.5 cap, and that like basically the carbon budget that would allow for a 1.5 rise in global temperatures will have been spent by the next time that they review agreements in 2020.
Thank you, Marlena. For anyone in the room who is not super familiar with the role of the climate movement and the role of indigenous resistance to fossil fuels, or why our panelists have been talking about that tonight. We're talking about it not just because it seems to be a trendy topic of calling out the work of indigenous groups, but because all around North America and the rest of the world, indigenous groups have been physically resisting fossil fuel and other types of extraction that have been poisoning their communities for well before the big green groups even existed. So I think that the climate movement is starting to a little bit catch on to the work that's been done and hopefully learn from the way these groups are approaching the topic, because we got so excited about those five demands that the It Takes Roots campaign put up there, and those ideals seem to line up at least with what I hope for in the world. Also, I've often seen that the work indigenous communities in resisting the fossil fuel projects is a community building project, and so we don't have to just learn what's been done and what's effective in indigenous communities to resisting fossil fuels as an obligation, but as a possibility for how we could envision community building in the white or settler communities as well. So we'll start the question and answer period here. And before we get started with that, I just wanted to sort of preface what this panel for the 350 PDX group, 350 Portland group. And 350 PDX has been engaged in a six-month campaign in which the Paris climate talks were sort of planted in the middle. And that campaign is called Road Through Paris. It's based on the idea that the Paris climate talks were never the end or the goal of the work that all of these people who are involved in the grassroots movement are doing, but instead, we know that there's work on the other side, and so let's start planning that before the talks happen. So we wanted to hear what happened at the Paris climate talks, not as a sort of assessment as to whether the entire grassroots movement has either succeeded or failed, but as a stepping stone along the way to succeeding in the goals that we all have and can achieve as people, united. So the question for the people in the back who couldn't hear is, there are so many issues, and as our panelists mentioned, they are connected, the intersection of the social and environmental justice issues that we see. How do we work on all of them when it's so hard to even just get through one of them?
The political context of this is really important. In my view, political means power. And currently we are facing extremely powerful forces, and whether you call it the capitalist, economic elite, or corporations, or whatever you call it, there are very powerful entrenched forces which have become much more powerful within our lifetimes, and which have a very deadly kind of power. And we cannot only, you know, do this as individuals. It's really important for us to move together. And in my very, you know, limited understanding of history, and I'm not a history person, but, you know, you definitely see that social change is really driven by social movements throughout history, whether you're looking at, you know, the labor movement or the women's movement or the civil rights movement. There have been movements. Movements are really the engine, in my view. But political voice, I think, is a very important part of social movements getting traction. And in my view, it's very important for us to also struggle politically because it's a unifier. It enables us to get to critical mass. And in my view, we have critical mass. We have critical mass. The numbers of people who support a basic agenda of justice, whether you're looking at 43 million young people who are trapped in debt right now, who deserve to be liberated from that debt. Our country chose to liberate the bankers and Wall Street who caused that debt. It's long past overdue time to liberate young people who are basically enslaved by that debt. And in my view, that's critical to the climate movement, because if we're going to have the force of a social movement, it needs to be led not only by frontline communities, but by youth, which is one of those frontline and very oppressed communities right now, who's saddled with debt and low-wage jobs and an economy that does not create new jobs, and the crisis of the climate. This is all falling on the shoulders of young people. So liberating young people, I think, is really critical as part of that movement, but that we need to come together in a more explicit way. And in the same way, we need to exercise, I think, direct action and civil disobedience out in the streets. We also need to do it in the voting booth and to use the tools of our democracy to stand up for what we deserve and to vote for what we are for, and not simply against what we fear. I think we need to bring our moral compass into our political life and really define the world that we want, not just retreat from the world we're afraid of, because doing that sort of leaves the predators to fill the gap. If we're not speaking up for the justice that we deserve, then we're essentially entrusting the corporate predatory political system to do it. So, you know, I think it's a very challenging time right now where it's us, you know, it's us joining together through the social movements, which are critical, and I think one hand also for political action, which is essentially about changing power. That if we want justice, we need power, and by we, I mean a broad coalition for people, planet, and peace over profit. We need that broad power of our numbers and to come together in an explicit way with a clear agenda, like that, you know, 5-point agenda of It Takes Roots. That really is a national agenda as well as a global agenda. This is the agenda for people, planet, and peace over profit. It's up to us.
That was Jill Stein, organizer, physician, and environmental health activist. She was the principal organizer for the Global Climate Convergence for People, Planet, and Peace Over Profit. She spoke as part of the report back from COP21, Paris Climate Talks. It was recorded on January 20th at the Peace House in Portland. Coming up on KBOO, at 10, just coming up, it's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints features a critique of Hillary Clinton's foreign policy and a crucial message from Leonard Peltier. At 11 on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen speaks with permaculture educator Marisha Auerbach about small space permaculture design. Plus, we discuss grape pruning. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not yet a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. The time is 9:58. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
Hi, this is John Chuck, host of Religion for Life. This week, I continue with the third part of my series, Meet Your Muslim Neighbor, by speaking with Harris Zafar. He's the national spokesperson of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community and author of Demystifying Islam, Tackling the Tough Questions. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, February 10th, 2016, and this is KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Today's guest returning, we were speaking on Monday with High Country News' senior editor, Jonathan Thompson. The recent edition that came out on the 8th of High Country News is the Sagebrush Insurrection. This, of course, for those who've been around these parts for a while,